Welcome back to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn, and I'm here with Suzanne Dorsey of the Baldhead Island Conservancy, UNCW Professor Larry Cahoon, and Duke University Professor Doug Novacek. We're talking today about the potential impacts of seismic testing on marine life. You can ask a question of our guests today by calling 910-343-1138 or sending an email to coastline@whqr.org. You can also tweet us at @CoastlineHQR. And Doug Novacek of Duke University, you were explaining the process of seismic testing when we so rudely interrupted you to go to break.
Oh, that's okay. No, not to worry. So once this impulse of sound comes from the guns and goes down into the bottom and refracts around, and which is exactly the data that is needed, it comes back up through the water column and received on hundreds of little hydrophones that are being towed out behind the vessel. And these can be very big rigs. I mean, they can be 3-4 kilometers long and as many kilometers wide. And so, it's a big ocean out there. So there's plenty of room for them to navigate around. But they are big operations.
And the sound that's produced, is a low frequency sound. That
primarily, yes.
Why is that so disturbing to marine mammals and fish?
Yeah, very good question. So the low frequencies are troublesome for a couple of reasons. One is that they travel very well, which is part of the reason they're used. They travel very well through the ocean. We also know that sea turtles, we know that tuna and other species of fishes, and certainly the large marine mammals are very sensitive to low frequencies, and they use those for navigation. They use them for We don't honestly know how turtles use sound all that much, but it's certainly possible that they are listening for the sounds of their own beaches or other hydrodynamic sounds that are made in the ocean. And so the low frequencies, because they travel well, they continue to travel well through the ocean. And depending on how far you are from the source and also where that source vessel is, you can hear those sounds for, in some cases, hundreds, thousands of kilometers away. Now, sometimes it dies out rather quickly, especially in shallow water. But, for example, on the shelf break, which is where that Manio prospect is that Dr. Cahoon mentioned, if that sound couples into the ocean, sounds from seismic surveys conducted off Nova Scotia and Brazil and Angola were heard in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, some 4,000 kilometers away. And again, that does depend on the specific propagation conditions and where the vessel is, but it does have the potential to travel for quite a long distance. The impact or the potential impacts at those ranges are really, really poorly understood. What it does do is it raises the background level of noise in the ocean. And think of yourself being at a loud party or a concert or something. And what happens when you have to raise your voice above that increased background noise? It changes the way you operate. It changes who you can hear and how much you can hear. And so those are some of our main concerns for things like turtles and right whales, their ability to communicate.
We have an email from Jason. He writes, I'm a charter fisherman and rely on healthy fisheries. What's the impact to tunas and sharks as a result of this testing? Doug Novacek?
Yeah, thanks. I certainly don't mean to dominate the conversation by any means. With fish, we certainly know from some research that fish can hear. They certainly make sound in some cases, not necessarily tunas. But I was just reading a report recently about the ability of tunas to hear low frequency sound. We don't know what happens to those highly migratory fish species when you conduct a survey in an area. It's quite likely that they would leave the area. We really just don't know. And I think, someplace like the Hatteras region that Dr. Cahoon described in the Manio prospect is shaping up to be one of, if not the most densely populated and diverse areas in the western North Atlantic, all of the western North Atlantic, for mammals, for fish, for seabirds, for turtles. And we really have a lack of information about what's the potential for impact in that in an area like that.
Suzanne Dorsey, you had something to add to that.
Yeah, a lot of these fish that we're talking about are already impacted. These are animals that have been harvested, so we do care about what their population levels are, particularly with endangered species, but with these fish, tuna, bluefin tuna, for example. If they're chased away from their food sources, that's going to impact their ability to reproduce and successfully repopulate the population. That impacts your ability to successfully catch them. So it is important if they're chased away from food.
UNCW's Larry Cahoon.
Yeah, I'd like to second what the others have said. The primary area of interest, the one that lies within the 50-mile exclusion zone and that Governor McCrory wants included in the area that can be leased for drilling, is an area they call the Point off Mandio. It overlies this Mandio prospect. Oceanographically, that's one of the most productive and biologically interesting places in the whole Western Atlantic. And as the others have said, this is where large aggregations of almost all the important species of birds, mammals, and so forth, fishes and so forth, accumulate. And these are their feeding grounds. And it's not a very big area, but that is exactly the place where almost all of the proposals for seismic exploration are intending to look.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking with a panel of scientists about the potential impacts of seismic testing off the coast of North Carolina. Here in the studio to answer your questions, UNCW Professor Larry Cahoon, Executive Director of the Baldhead Island Conservancy, Suzanne Dorsey, and Doug Novacek, Professor of Marine Science and Conservation at Duke University. We have a caller. Jim, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you. My question is, if we did seismic testing in the late 70s, why isn't that data still valid today, and why do we have to repeat to gather the same information after seismic testing's been done? The ocean bottom hasn't changed, I don't think, since then.
That's a very good question.
I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Jim. Larry Cahoon.
Well, the technology's gotten a lot better. That was 40-some years ago. The actual techniques they use for seismic have evolved over time. That's one answer. Another is that the processing capabilities that we had for handling the data are much more sophisticated now. If you think back to what computers were like in the 1970s, they weren't very capable. We have vaster capability now to process the data. And we have upgraded the seismic techniques that we use for this sort of thing considerably. In addition, our understanding of the geology out there is more sophisticated now than it was then. There are other potential prospects out there that were not explored. And so, you know, there is a legitimate need to find out what else might be out there. I find it interesting that Governor McCrory is confident in saying that 40% of the resource lies within the 50-mile zone. Well, the whole point of exploration is to figure out where the resource is and what it is. And how do they already know that? There's a non sequitur in there.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about potential impacts of seismic testing off the coast of North Carolina. If you have a question for our science panel, give us a call, 910-343-1138. Pete from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Good afternoon. I had two questions, but the one doctor seemed to answer it regarding convergence zones and the impact on distant marine life. Anyone that's dealt with sonar knows that the whale that's 20 miles away may say, "What was that noise?" And the whale that's 80 miles away may suddenly have a ruptured eardrum. But it sounds like you're pretty much on board with that. So I see both sides on this issue. This is one of the issues that I'm kind of schizophrenic about. But my question is, those of you that are opposing this, are you equally opposing the offshore wind farm proposal, which will place high-voltage cables under the seafloor with a totally unknown impact on those animals that use geomagnetism to navigate?
That's a very...
And I'll take my answer off here.
Thank you so much. That's a very good question. Suzanne Dorsey.
Certainly, sea turtles use geomagnetism to navigate, so it is a concern that we would want to explore and look at mitigation if that was the decision of our community to move forward with that. I think any of these new technologies deserve to have a community look very clearly at all the pros and cons. And, you know, these endangered animals, very small impacts on their populations can really drive the population down to a point of no return. And I might add that at least on Baldhead, where we do intensive conservation, there's an economic impact. We've done research that indicates that annually our sea turtle conservation program brings in $30 million to our island economy. So it's not just the animals. It may also be our community's diverse and important economy as well.
Larry Cahoon.
Let me make a comment about the opposition or whatever. You know, as scientists, certainly I can speak for myself, and I would assume I speak for my colleagues here. Our job is to close the gap between what we know and what we ought to know. And it's not so much that we take a position in opposition or support of an activity. It's that we advocate for getting the information we need to make an appropriate decision.
Thanks for that. You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about potential impacts of seismic testing, and we have an email from Tim. And, Tim, I apologize in advance. It's a very involved email, so I'm going to do my best to summarize it here. But he says, I find it nothing short of an embarrassment to North Carolina to watch a governor who will not defend the state's environment and who is clearly willing to sell out our best interests to satisfy the powers that fund his political party. Governor McCrory's position on oil development, that snort was from Larry Cahoon, which is, it's radio. Sometimes I wish we had an in-studio camera here. Governor McCrory's position on oil development is wrong for North Carolina, wrong for the U.S., and wrong for the planet as a whole. He says there are three deceptions here. First, offshore drilling is not safe, nor is it well regulated. Second, the supposed high-paying jobs that the governor touts simply will not materialize for North Carolina residents. And third, petroleum expansion is a bad course for the nation and for the whole planet in the long term. Doug Novacek, you've talked about the realities of the need for energy exploration. And having been present on vessels that are conducting seismic testing, where do you stand on that side of the argument?
Well, I think I certainly sympathize with the email that came in, and when I said we all need energy, we need energy to live our daily lives. But I would certainly ask whether, you know, given our current status in the world as number one or number two exporter of petroleum products, do we need to be drilling off North Carolina right now? I do agree with Dr. Cahoon that, you know, our role as scientists is to provide information and to close those gaps. I think that there certainly are problems. I've been on the ships, and I know that, you know, the focus of, in terms of the seismic, the focus is to, in terms of mitigation, is to keep individual animals from being harmed. And that look only, you know, the people on the ship are only looking out about 500 meters or so to make sure that no animals get underneath the array and actually get injured. Of course, you don't know about fish and turtles or deep diving pelagic animals, because they, you can't see them most of the time. And so the mitigation measures are inadequate in many ways, because there are lots of animals we don't see. So I think that, again, in addition to what the email stated, I think what's not been part of the conversation also is the alternative technologies to getting the same data. And if I could, Rachel, just to revisit the quickly related message about why do we need to look if we already looked. I agree with Larry, certainly, but we do need to keep in mind that as we look at these permit applications for seismic, all of which overlap on the area off Cape Hatteras, which I think is a really important discussion to have. But in addition, there's no regulation that would restrict the same two different companies from conducting a seismic survey in the same piece of water one day after another. And there's no mechanism in place to keep us from having 10 times the impact when we could have one times the impact if we really needed to go out and look for offshore energy.
Well, Doug,
I think there's some structure. Yeah.
Doug Novacek from Duke University, that point that you're raising right now is a point that has been consistently raised by scientists, the redundancy of the seismic testing that's likely to happen. There are 9 applications that are out there right now. Is that correct? 10 now, Larry Cahoon. So why is there such redundancy? Why isn't there a limit on the number of operations?
Well, there are a couple things driving it. One is that it's a very proprietary industry. The same geology and geophysics company, or G&G company, could shoot one survey one day, sell the data to one oil and gas company, any of the E&P companies, and then shoot the same survey the next day and sell the data to somebody else because they're under a different contract. There are differences in the configurations of the seismic air gun arrays that do alter the signal a bit, but as Larry alluded to, the processing techniques are what's really come a long way, and a lot of the information the companies get is in the processing of those techniques. And just one last thing quickly is that there is precedent for doing this differently off the West African coast. I believe it was Angola. The government decided that they were going to sponsor as large a seismic survey as was necessary. And the government then owned the data and sold it to all the companies to do their own processing. And if those communities could come together and decide on one survey configuration, again, I wouldn't advocate that it goes off on Hatteras either, but then everybody wins. The government owns the data and sells it. The companies spend a lot less money to get the data than they have to at $100,000 or more dollars a day for a ship. But again, Rachel, these are the types of discussions that have not been had, and I think we're rushing to judgment on it.
So there's a model for that, at least, in terms of the number of operators out there. On March 30th, a district court in Hawaii sided with the Natural Resources Defense Council, finding the National Marine Fisheries Service violated multiple requirements of the Marine Mammal Protection Act and the Endangered Species Act when agreeing to the Navy's plan for training and testing off the shores of Southern California and Hawaii. Will that court decision have any impact on what's happening here on the East Coast? Has that set any kind of legal precedent? Larry Cahoon?
I've heard of this somewhat indirectly, and the answer is yes. They got into big trouble for not doing their job properly, and that has, according to the sources I've tapped into, forced NOAA, the parent agency, to back up and take a hard look with their lawyers as to how they handle forthcoming proposals. So that is going to have an impact somewhere down the road.
You're listening to Coastline. Sure, Doug Novacek.
Yeah, sorry. I agree with Larry. The precedent is important, and some of the numbers, just for folks quickly, the Marine Mammal Protection Act restricts or forbids the taking of marine mammals, and that can come in a couple different varieties. One is straight out mortality. Another one is an injury take, and then another is a behavioral impact. And that environmental impact statement for Hawaii and California had millions of behavioral takes and some thousands of injury potential takes. And it was based on that the court said, how can this possibly be negligible? And the programmatic EIS for Atlantic Seismic has similar numbers.
Suzanne Dorsey.
Yeah, I really believe that what we're talking about here is directly applicable to turtles. Amanda Williard, a UNCW professor who studies physiology in diving sea turtles, indicated that there's an overwintering population of sea turtles right exactly where we're talking about in the northern part of our state, right on the edge of the Gulf Stream. It's very interesting that this is a population there exactly during the time when the seismic testing would take place. And if it did scare them away, we're talking about cold stunned turtles, which we've seen before in the state of North Carolina. We know this can happen, and it can have a devastating impact on the population.
Thanks for that. We're talking about the potential impacts of seismic testing off the coast of North Carolina. We're going to go to break in just a moment, and we have Jack from Hampstead on the line. We'll talk with Jack as soon as we come back from the break. If you have a question for our science panel about seismic testing, give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org or tweet us using coastlinehqr. Do that. No one ever does that. You're listening to Coastline.